You're listening to the Journey On podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick is a horseman, trainer, international clinician, and author who helps empower horse people from all over the world with the skills, knowledge, and mindsets needed to create trusting partnerships with their horses. Warwick offers a free 7-day trial to his comprehensive online video library that includes hundreds of full-length training videos and several home study courses at videos.warwickschiller.com. Just because you
see what he showed. G'day everyone, welcome back to the Journey On podcast. I'm your host Warwick Schiller, and one of my previous guests was Linda Kohanov. And Linda, apart from writing The Tao of Equus, also wrote a book called The Way of the Horse, Equine Archetypes for Self-Discovery. So there was a guidebook and a card deck in that particular pack. And today my guest is Kim McElroy. Kim is the artist who painted the card deck of Linda's Way of the Horse, Equine Archetypes for Self-Discovery. And I'm just going to read you Kim's bio off her website. It says, Kim McElroy has been drawn to horses since childhood, and as soon as she could hold a crayon, this manifested as her art. For more than 30 years, she's been known for her intuitive understanding of the sentient nature of horses and her ability to infuse her art with their spiritual energy. She distills this energy into expression of the horse's quintessential essence in ways that transcend how they are traditionally defined. Through her incredible mastery of pastels and her talent in writing about her visionary insights, she conveys the power and beauty of the horse's form. Yet more than that, she offers us a timeless glimpse into its soul. And after having a conversation with Kim, I would say that's a very good representation, not only of her art, but of the way she views horses and the way she views the world. So I hope you guys enjoy this chat as much as I did recording it. Kim McElroy, welcome to the Journey On podcast.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
So you seem to be one of those very lucky people whose passion ends up being their career, what they do for a living. And so I want to kind of explore how you ended up being one of those lucky people. So why don't you tell us what exactly you do, and then we're going to unravel how you got there.
I will. Thank you. I'm a visionary equine artist. I paint horses in ways that they're not traditionally defined, and I work in pastel. I've been doing this for almost 40 years.
Okay, let's unravel that. Can you tell us exactly? You told us that a visionary equine artist is someone who portrays them in ways they're not usually portrayed. Okay, so we've got rid of what they're usually portrayed in. How do you portray them?
Yeah. Well, in the beginning, when I started painting horses, I was new to the horse world. I loved horses as a child and grew up wanting to be a horse, playing horse, and not having much access to horses until I was about 8 years old. And that was my introduction to horses at a boarding stable where my parents signed me up for lessons. So that was my first introduction to what people even really did with horses other than reading Misty of Chincoteague and some of the, you know, the Black Beauty and those books. But my dream world of horses collided with the real world of horses. And when I began being around horses and seeing what people did with them, I was confused. So I thought, well, I must have just made it all up, but I just kept drawing that world all through my childhood and into school, and I was rewarded for my art and people loved it. So but it never occurred to me that I could just paint horses. And later in life, as in my 20s, when I began my early 20s, when I was going to art college, I had an encounter with horses that changed everything. And it reaffirmed the feelings that I'd had, that there were connections with horses that were honest and true, and they weren't just about riding them or just about what people did with them in the world. And ironically, when I started exhibiting my artwork, I went to the horse world because that was the place where horse people were that might buy my work. And I got ensconced in the sport world for a while because that's how I was introduced. One of my our dear friends and a patron of mine was into horse racing, so I began going to the backside of the track and learning about all the sports and the accomplishments of horses in the world. And I was drawn up into the or pulled into the celebrity of that and was fascinated by it for a while. But then I the more I was around that, the more I began to feel that there was a discrepancy between how people felt about horses, the love for horses and the connection with horses and why they're with horses, why they're intrigued by them, and then what they do with them and how they justify or reconcile the fact that the people that were sensitive to their, you know, who they are as beings would just sort of shut that part down or talk about it behind closed doors because they were faced with the dilemma of what to do with horses and feel that way at the same time. And then there were other people who really didn't believe that horses felt that way. But the people that I encountered with my art immediately opened up that conversation. And the more that conversation happened about what am I actually painting and what horses are to those who resonate with what I paint, then there was more more of a gap between me wanting to paint sports even. So I began shifting into more and more of a where my art started, which was about the flow and about connection and having an experience of resonating with the horse's beingness and their movements and their spirit in my own body and drawing that. And then I began to be really honest about how I wanted to come out of the closet, as it were, and say that's who horses are, and that's what I want to paint and who I want to connect with in my audience. And the more I began to do that, the more of those kinds of people resonated with me. So I then no longer had to paint the celebrity horses or the sports in order to connect with the people that I wanted to connect with.
That's interesting, the whole when you come out of the quote-unquote, when you come out of the closet. You know, I'm a big fan of Brené Brown, and when she talks about vulnerability, and you know, you always think that if you are vulnerable and express how you really feel about some things, that everybody will laugh at you. But what you tend to find is you're not alone, and people will say, "Me too."
Exactly.
I was going to ask you about the you said horses in sport, and you mentioned racing. Was that mostly racing?
It was racing. I tried some different venues, even horse shows, because I got into the very beginning of my career. My mom and I were in business together. She was a great supporter of mine, thank goodness. And our first introduction to the horse world was through Arabian horse shows, because in those days, this was in the mid-80s, that's the only horse events and horse expos there were in the country. There weren't these big, you know, main event kinds of things. So the only real attractive trade shows were at the Arabian horse shows. And, of course, I loved Arabians, and they were one of my introductions to this feeling of that beauty and that spirit. And when I saw them at Liberty for the first time in my life at the age of 20. So that was my introduction to the horse show world and the celebrity of, you know, how beautiful a horse could be and breeding stallions and marketing and all that stuff. And stepping into that trade show world was really a lot of fun. And then I tried to exhibit my work at, you know, different events like show jumping and dressage and polo. And so each event I went to, trying to find this audience that would love the horse, depending on the amount of the engagement that particular sport had with the horse, had with the horse as a celebrity, versus the person as a celebrity. There was all sorts of mixes of what that was. And I discovered very quickly that some of the sports, didn't matter what I painted that was, expressing, even if it was that sport, because some people only wanted in that sport to see a certain type of art, of what, depicting what they loved. And sometimes it wasn't even, like they didn't need to see that in their home, for instance. But with the Arabian horse events, at least I had the feeling that those people really loved the horse first and foremost. They loved the Arabian horse. And so I could paint an Arabian horse in other circumstances or other styles or other expressions, and they would love that too. It didn't have to be their horse. It didn't have to be the sport they were into or whatever. So that was part of what my evolution was.
Sounds like it's an interesting journey into different horse sports and see how interested in horses that particular sport is. And it's interesting you start out with racing, because I think horse racing is a completely false horse sport. And I don't mean the people who are involved in racing don't like horses. But the only reason horse racing exists on the level it exists is because you can gamble on it.
Right.
And all the prize money doesn't come from interest in horses. Like, say, dressage, okay? There is no prize money in dressage. But if you want to buy a Olympic-level horse, you're looking at millions of dollars, because there are people interested, right or wrongly, you know, interested in the horse itself and the activity it does, and they'll pay money for that. But if you, I always have this thought that if you took gambling out of horse racing, no one would show up. There would be, no one would show up. There still might be horse racing. The people in the racing industry, well, it would certainly sort them out to see if you're in this because you like racing horses, or you're in this because it makes a lot of money and it just happens to be horse racing. But I've always had this thought, what if you, if you made gambling on horse races illegal, would there be any horse racing?
Yeah.
I mean, there might be one down the back pasture, you know, like if you think about, you know, my horse is faster than your horse sort of thing. But
right.
But you know, if you took the money out of almost any other horse sport, people would still be doing it.
Exactly.
And you know, it's probably always irked me, and this is probably part of my stuff, but you know, I'd be on a plane somewhere and people say, oh, what do you do? I'm a horse trainer. Oh, race horses. It's like, you know, that is not horse training.
I had, yeah, in fact, the horses aren't allowed to do anything but you know, go in one direction and really fast.
So, yeah, and you know, and I'm not a fan of the horse racing industry, just because as someone who helps people with their horses solve issues, and most of those issues are behavioral issues, and those behavioral issues are mental health issues in horses. There are no mentally well-adjusted horses that come out of horse racing. You know,
no,
they have
exactly.
They all have to be retrained to be a safe general horse to, you know, to be around. And so, you know, so there's the money bit, and then the horses that come out of there aren't horses anyway. They're you know, they've got PTSD basically. They're like soldiers right. coming back from overseas sort of thing. And everybody thinks, oh, horse racing, it's so wonderful. I'm not, you know, I'm not a fan of it. I'm not going to condone it. For me, it's like the thing about the money, it's just it's an interesting thought I've always had. Like, if you couldn't gamble on horse racing, would there actually be any horse racing?
And not only the gambling, but the ownership of the horse racing is gambling. I mean, they, you know, those gamblers that, for the most part, that own the horses are gambling on a larger scale. They just invest, or they breed, or whatever, and they they are gambling that that horse will make them money. And if they don't make them money, then they're a liability or they're, you know, too expensive. And then they go the way of not a good life. And I was really, once I started listening and asking questions and observing all that, I had the same reaction. I was like, you know, there's the wonderful people who work on the backside, who work with the horses, who love them. But, and there's the fans who truly, will just go for that particular horse that they're rooting for, regardless of whether they bet on them. But those are the exceptions. And I rescued a racehorse off the track, so I know full well, the trauma and the rehab and the, where you can't resolve or help, even if a horse is not even ridden. It's just her, the rest of her life, she was damaged by that. So, yeah. Mm.
Interesting. So let's go back to your childhood. Where did you grow up?
Long Beach, California, Southern California.
Long Beach is, like you said, there weren't many horses available. Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Long Beach is more surf-oriented, isn't it? Yeah.
No, I was just going to say, actually, it wasn't even that interesting because it had a breakwater, so the beach was totally boring and flat. Didn't have wild waves or beautiful nature there, really.
So people from other parts of the world who might not be familiar with California, I think because of TV, everybody thinks California is Baywatch.
Right.
that's Southern California. I'm in Central California and there's Northern California, but it's almost like two or three different countries. But LA is, yeah, the LA is a different kettle of fish, and yeah, that's Baywatch, California.
Yeah, we had a beautiful area where I lived in. It's called Belmont Shore, so it's kind of a Carmel or a small town within the larger town, so it has a bit more character and more of a local feel of the town of where the shops are and stuff. And my great aunt had built a beautiful home on the hill in the 30s when she and her husband struck oil. So it was kind of a beautiful home to grow up in with my parents, and my older siblings were out of the house by then. So So Long Beach was a beautiful area to grow up in, but it was definitely void of horses.
So they struck oil in LA?
In Signal Hill, right in that area in the 30s.
Yeah, you don't think of California as being oil place, but where we are in Paso Robles, just about 5-10 miles north of here, there's a lot of oil wells.
Oh, yeah. It's interesting. There's a one of my favorite movies is called The 13th Floor, and it has scenes that go back into the 30s in that part of the country. And there was oil rigs everywhere in Beverly Hills. There was oil all over California. Yeah, is probably.
Wow.
Oil rigs just 20 miles from where I grew up, even though it was a kind of a upscale area.
So as a child, what did you want to be?
I wanted to be a horse. that didn't work out so well. So I played horse for a while on my hands and knees until I started going to school, and then that was sort of frowned on. So the kids I encountered in school didn't really understand, you know, my interest in animals. So I just, got quiet about that. But the art at least gave me a bit of, people could admire me for that. But so the art was the other side of that coin. I was good at art. I loved drawing. And I always tell the story that actually I think that probably the moments, because there's never, just one, but one of the moments when I decided to become an artist was when my parents and I used to go out to eat. And, I'd occupy myself with drawing on the paper napkins or the paper placemats. And at one point, one of the waitresses walked up and she said, "Oh, isn't that lovely?" or whatever. And I was so tickled that I handed her the drawing, and she got so sweet. And she said, oh my gosh, I just have to give you something. This is just so sweet of you. So she took me over to the counter and they had a glass case with cookies inside. And she gave me this big Snoopy cookie. And I thought, hey, this is a pretty good deal, you know, if I can make somebody happy and get a cookie. So that's pretty much where it started.
You mentioned a minute ago something about at school, the art. I don't want to put words in your mouth because these weren't the exact words you said, but it was basically the art drew people's attention to me, or I got, you know, it was basically you were saying you got kind of positive feedback from that. And I'm always fascinated by what people are drawn to do, and especially why they're drawn to do it. And do you feel there was an element of that in your attraction to art? And do you think there's an element of that to what led you further into it?
Yeah, as I said that, I kind of remarked on that because I hadn't really said that before in that way, though I wrote a little story once where I said, you know, where the antagonist in the character, like a children's book, the girl who drew horses, the antagonist or the person who was, you know, the friction in the story was I made up as a character, but it must have been based on someone that someone, you know, that she was made fun of as a child, and that this girl came over and saw her drawing of horses and said, that's pretty. And it was somebody that, you know, normally would have never noticed me or her, the character. It was, you know, so it was like the kids that did know that I did art, if, you know, on the edges of my notebook or if I entered a contest at school or something, not everybody knew I was an artist, but I would say for the most part that people that I encountered that I was intimidated by, I was shy and not in the popular crowd. We're talking about big schools. These are schools of, you know, thousands of students. So it was not a very small, friendly environment. And also I think the teachers were very supportive. I found a lot of resources from early on, and especially in my junior high years. I had one particular art teacher that just took me under his wing and was very encouraging and supportive, and suggested and enrolled me in an accelerated art program. So I got to be sort of taken out of that environment and bussed half a day to a specialty school that only taught art. I mean, that was so thrilling to be accepted and to win that scholarship, and B, to be removed from the world that was not as much fun, and to go do art half a day was, you know, totally thrilling. So I think I had both the experience of someone like the waitress supporting me right from the get-go, like, you're doing something magical. I'd like to, you know, reward you for that. And then other people who I was intimidated or scared about how to be in that world with them, that world was also made easier and more friendly because I was able to do something different than they could, I guess, or that they knew they could.
So it sounds like it was, you know, sounds like it was a passion, but it was also a passion with friends with benefits. It was, you know, you had some added benefits from it as well.
Yeah, and I always have said that I was so fortunate that my parents never they always celebrated my talents, and they didn't say, you know, well, you can't draw, you know, or that's not a way to make it in the world or any of that. Like a lot of artists have expressed that, the angst about not being able to do their craft. And I was always thankfully supported in that and with my teachers. So it was a no guess as to what I would become. But it was in me from the time I could hold a crayon, and I Thankfully, my mom has saved those early childhood drawings, and horses were the main theme. In fact, I feel very strongly that that the kinship between horses and I was, you know, long before birth. And my first horse, my racehorse that I rescued, Dharma, was a bay mare. And my early drawings that were recognizable, that weren't just, you know, green horses with pink manes, were bay horses. And so I've always been fascinated by that as well.
I was artistic as a kid, loved to draw. I was always drawing, and always drawing horses too. So, you know, my walls of my bedroom were covered with pictures of horses, all pictures of horses that I'd drawn.
Wow.
And I, you know, I took some art classes like after school at a local, what you might call a community college here in America. But I almost didn't want to learn to draw. I only wanted to draw horses. You know what I mean? I didn't want to do the other stuff.
Right. Me too. Yeah, but depending on the teacher.
You obviously stuck with it enough to actually do the other stuff. That was my question. So when you went to college, you went to a college for art?
Yeah, my mom and I moved up to the Northwest in when I was 15, and I finished high school up here and continued doing art. And then there was a wonderful small, very, very small, like 10 students art college that opened up just half an hour from me. So that was an easy and friendly introduction to the art without a lot of pressure of college and not even necessarily a bachelor's degree pursued. It was an associate of art degree, so it was just a 2-year college. So it was a lot just more freedom of expression, not a lot of peer pressure. Some of the students were older. Like when I had been in high school and got accepted into the accelerated art program, most of the students were older than I. So that was, and it just took it out of the peer pressure side of it. Like everybody was supportive, and same with the college. And then I, when I started my passion of painting horses because of the horse encounter, and I just realized that I didn't want to just be an illustrator of somebody else's projects working for hire, that I wanted to paint my own concepts and my own feelings, then I thought that I should get a degree because that's what you do. And so I went to a real, you know, official art college in Seattle. And that was a shock because it was back in not only the academia, but the a whole different approach to art, which was avant-garde and like the more abstract and the more it challenged people's reality, the more it was called art. And I had been painting more life drawing and figures and seeking ways to communicate with the audience through advertising and you know, illustration. And then I went into the fine arts school, that was more about let's shock somebody into thinking this is beautiful or not even beautiful, thinking this is art, I should say. So their definition of art was completely different than mine. And I realized very quickly I wasn't going to progress much there. And so I never got my bachelor's degree, but it doesn't matter. I followed my passion.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was that was going to be one of my questions, was how was it going to arts, you know, because I brought up the fact that I went to art classes, but I only wanted to draw horses, and how was it going to art school and, you know, there's probably such a broad range of things they have you do there. So you didn't last there?
No, I didn't. I chose not to finish, and I chose because of my mom's support and also the horse equation. I realized that I didn't need a degree to do what I loved, and so I started pursuing the horse events and selling my work directly to the public right from the beginning. What I had been so gifted to receive was in my early education, there's a book by a woman named Betty Edwards. She wrote a book called Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain, and it's quite famous now. It was her master's thesis to teach everyone to draw, and that to prove that it's not just a skill that people are born with, that it is a number of things, and part of it is using the right side of your brain. And that was a great introduction to how to express drawings in such a way that wasn't only based on the photorealism or perspective or, you know, the things that I was taught in school. And so that was a really great introduction to the work that I do as well, because one of the techniques is called gesture drawing, and it's drawing a model, but instead of a pose they're holding for half an hour or something, and you're drawing in great detail every part of their anatomy, you know, anatomically based drawing. It was gestures as in, you know, them just doing something with their hand, and you trying to draw that before, you know, which of course it's in your mind's eye because you can't record it, but the feeling of it. And that was the key to what ended up being my epiphany about drawing horses.
So there's been a couple of times you've mentioned an encounter with horses that changed everything. Mm-hmm. You've alluded to that. What was that encounter?
Yeah. So I was in my first year of art college. I'd been practicing lots of techniques and mediums. And we had a spring break, and we went to visit dear friends who lived in Arroyo Grande, and they had Arabian horses. And I had met their horses over the years. In fact, the first time I ever tried to ride one of their horses, with their permission, she took off with me and I nearly fell off. So, riding wasn't always my cup of tea, but I loved being on the ground with them. So I had to fill my sketchbook for homework for class, and I was visiting the horses in the barn, loving being with them, but they were snapping and, you know, standing in the stalls, and I was like, you know, what do I draw here? And how do I, you know, it's not very interesting to draw anatomy, right? So our friend Geska just happened to come along, and she was an artist too, so that was intriguing later in the story. But anyway, she said, you know, I see what you're trying to do. Would you like me to let them out into the arena? And if I back up a little bit to my early childhood, taking riding lessons at the boarding stable, the magical times that I ended up spending with those horses was when everyone went home and they stopped riding and training the horses, and I just got to hang out with them at an empty stable when everyone gone to lunch. And so my only experience of being with horses and humans was that horses were trained or done something with and then put back in a box. So there was no liberty. There was no even lunging much or a round pen or anything. There was no horse without a lead. And so I'd never actually seen a horse at liberty. And so she said, Geska said, would you like me to let the horses out into the arena? And I didn't even really know what that meant. I was 20 years old by this time. And, you know, this was the days before the internet and a lot of television about horses running. So I probably had seen it maybe, but I'd never felt it, I should say, because I'd never been in the presence of horses that did this. And she let the horses out, and I had my sketchbook all ready. I'm going to draw these horses. And they started running around with their tails up in the air and snorting and tossing their heads. And I'm standing in the middle of the arena. And fortunately, I didn't feel unsafe, but I was caught up in this emotion and this beauty that they were expressing. And all I could think of was, how am I going to draw that? And I just got past that resistance, and I kept drawing, even though I had no idea what I was going to do. And a few pages went by, and I just started realizing that I couldn't capture the impression of them in my mind's eye long enough to know what they were doing. I couldn't paint them anatomically. So I just grounded myself, I guess. I didn't know how to do that at the time, but I became centered in myself, and I wanted to grasp the feeling, like reaching out and taking that feeling of what they were doing in midair, usually, and draw it on paper somehow. And this gesture drawing technique that I had learned of the models holding these quick poses was like exponentially shortened, because the quick pose was, you know, a split second. But I started sketching these horses, and I call them spirit sketches, these line drawings of horses in motion, interlapping and weaving together, and you can't always tell what's a leg, and, you know, but the faces and the tails and the movement was captured. And I was astonished and excited. And after they calmed down, I went to talk with Geska. I showed the drawings to her because she was an artist. I wanted to see what she thought. And she said, these are remarkable. And I said, really? They're just scribbles. And she said, no, they're really quite beautiful. And she pointed at this one drawing and she said, is that Hala, the name of her horse? And I said, she had three horses. And I said, how can you tell? It's just a bunch of lines. And she said, it just feels like him. Mm. And that was just an awakening of there's something here. And when I went back to school, I began thinking, I want to draw this way. This is not illustration. This is not, conveying something in a realistic way, though I do a lot of realistic work now. But that was the genesis of the feeling connection and the rapport that I was able to put into something visionary or visible on paper. And then having her confirm and other people later confirm, I feel that when I look at that, then that was something really intriguing to me. So I discovered my instructor had pastel, which is like it's a dry medium, like a chalk sort of. And I wanted to capture something, the same spontaneity, that didn't involve mixing paints and getting into that kind of complexity. I just wanted to draw. And I never used pastel. And when I began picking them up and drawing, they came out in that same spontaneous flow. So that was the introduction to pastel. And I've never worked with any medium since.
Do you have, on your website, do you have some of those, what do you call them, spirit drawings?
Spirit sketches, yeah.
Do you have some of them on there? Mm-hmm.
I do.
Okay. I have seen them, and they're almost like, they're moving. It's not a still thing. You can kind of feel the energy in them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I still create from that place, whether I'm doing the realism or not. The movement is, and the life is always a part of my work. It's not a static thing at all. Yeah.
Mm. So you mentioned Geska in that, and when you first mentioned her, you said like there was an aside, something about something else Geska did or told you or something or other. Do you know what that is?
Yeah, that was the moment where she first that she had the impulse to let the horses out, which was lovely, and then the fact that she was an artist and she recognized that that her horse was this one drawing, and she supported my initial launch into this unknown expression of my art, and it meant a lot to me because she was an artist. And she knew her horses, and for her to say, that's my horse in this wildly abstract horse-like drawing was very, very much a part of my feeling that I was doing something new in myself and maybe to others, because she was saying, in her experience as an artist and in her probably her knowledge of art history or whatever, that this was unique. And that gave me a lot of faith in keeping going with it.
Mm. You know, what else I thought was really interesting in that is you'd been interested in horses since you were a small child, and you're 20 years old and you realize you thought that horses either lived in a stall or had a human on their back. And those were the two options available to horses.
Yeah. It's funny when I look back, I think, well, I must have seen movies or this or that. But as I said the story today, I realized maybe it was because I'd never actually experienced it. Being in the presence of horses who were at liberty, or been, you know, near a herd of wild horses or, you know, that kind of thing. There's something about that energy when you're with it. When you first experience it, it's like a light bulb goes off. You know, there's something there that's when they're able to express themselves that way, their completely natural way, that that just drew me like a magnet and made me want to figure that out. What is that? That's what I had wanted to be as a child. Whenever I played horse and galloped around on my hands and knees, I was always, again, the sport theme was like, I wanted to be a wild horse. I didn't want to be a dressage horse. And when you talk to kids, a lot of times, if they do play horse, they're usually playing a show horse, or they're playing riding a horse, like a hobby horse, or they are the rider. There's only a few kids, even in all my career, that I've shared this story, that there's a few adults that'll say, yeah, I was the horse too. And it's almost like a secret code word, like, you know, oh yeah, I get that, you know.
You got to come up with a secret handshake for that.
Right. Secret hoof shake.
Secret hoof shake. You mentioned earlier that you moved up to the Northwest, and I just wanted to point out for viewers who might not know, listeners who might not know what that means, that's up Washington State, and it's the top Northwest corner of the United States. And if you haven't been there, it's beautiful. It's beautiful trees and forests and quite a wet place, though. Rains a lot.
Rains a lot, which is why it's so beautiful. But you have weather here, right? In Southern California, you know, weather is not very prevalent. It's always sunshine, you know. So it's nice to have weather and storms and clouds and waves and nature. Great influence on me.
You get to experience a broader range of weather, you know. And it's interesting, just on Facebook today it popped up. So I've been doing ice baths for a number of years now, and I didn't realize how long I'd been doing it, but today just before I got in here with you, a thing popped up on Facebook. It was a memory from 5 years ago, and I was in Utah, and I went up to visit a horseman named West Taylor, and I didn't know anything about West Taylor, but I just had this like intuition, like I need to go talk to this guy. And I had just started doing these ice baths, and I was telling him about them, and he said, oh, there's a ice covered lake just down the road from here. So I said, tomorrow we should go down there and do an ice bath. So the next day we went down there and stripped down their underwear and had to actually stomp holes in the ice on this, so the whole lake's frozen, stomp holes in the ice on this lake and get in and do a 2-minute cold plunge. But the thing about, like, say the ice baths, or if you're going to get in a sauna or whatever, is you're exposing your body to a much broader range of temperatures than we have in our air-conditioned houses and our heated houses, which is how we're supposed to live. And yeah, Southern California is not, you know, it doesn't have a very broad range of temperatures and weather patterns, whereas, yeah, you go to other places and you get to experience that a bit more. And, you know, Washington State's so cool because, I don't know, it feels like you're always out in nature, wherever you are there.
Yeah, even when you're in the city. And we don't live in the city, but we have a beautiful, and I grew up coming up to the Hood Canal, which is about an hour and a half from here, which is its own waterway and not as many population. So it's much more wild than where I live. But, you know, to be surrounded by, to go to a beach and shuck oysters and swim with, you know, the otters and, you know, it was such an incredible experience coming from a California desert beach of no life whatsoever, not even a seashell. And then to come to, you know, the wilds of the Northwest was very inspiring.
Speaking of cold plunges, if you're going swimming at the beach in Washington, you're having a cold plunge.
Yeah, we waited until in the summertime when the tide would go out, it would heat up the beach, and you had about 2 hours, an hour or two before the water got too cold to swim in. And so we would swim in the shallows when it would heat up the water. It was really fun.
Oh, that was on those 2 days when the sun comes out?
Right. In the summertime, it's it's more sunny.
I judged a raining show up there years ago, and it was in the middle of summer.
Literally a raining show, right?
Yeah. It wasn't raining, but it was overcast and cloudy and cool. And then the sun came out for about 2 hours, and I said something about it, and they said, oh, that was summer.
Right. Well, it's actually a conspiracy. The weather report on the news always says it's raining here, and we look out and we go, nah, you know. But we don't want people knowing how beautiful it is. So,
well, you want to keep it a secret. You don't want all the Californians moving there. You want them to keep moving to Texas, Austin,
which of
Texas.
Course I was one.
So in the intro, I mentioned that you had done the artwork for Linda Kohanov's card deck. Can you tell us about how you met Linda and how all that came about?
Yeah, that was a very fortuitous event, series of events. So as I'm sure you feel, horses are usually the catalyst to something magical in our lives. And in my case, my mare, Dharma, the ex-racehorse who was so troubled, my quest to help her
heal. Was her name Dharma when you got her?
It was. Yeah,
really?
Dharma. Yeah. And actually, I thought it was misspelled for a long time because it was spelled D-A-R-M-A. And then I just recently looked up for the millionth time the word Dharma and found that that is one of the spellings. So whoever named her that decided that's how they spelled it. But anyway, it means the chosen path among amazing a million other things. But as opposed to karma, it means, you know, what you do with the life energy you're given and how to be in flow and in synchronicity with it. So she was that for me. And by way of trying to resolve what needed to be healed. And what I didn't know at the time was not only what needed to be healed for her, but what needed to be healed within me. And so I... in her behaviors and my novice skills as a horsewoman, which were, you know, very minimal, I was trying to figure out how to even just lead her in a straight line or walk her without her going into a fight or flight. And that was my introduction to animal communicators, and I had always believed in such things, but to actually speak with someone who could speak with Dharma at a distance was really remarkable. And that first communicator I worked with, her name was Sharon Callahan. This was back in 97, so it was still kind of a new thing in the popular culture. I had a session with her, and one of the things she said was, you know, have you thought about the fact, she says, I often find with my clients that their animals are also exhibiting something within them that is not just their behavior, but they're tapping into something that you need to resolve. And that was totally a new concept for me. And not that long after that, because I was going through some challenges in my life at that time. So it made sense in looking back. And so anyway, Linda had been interviewing Sharon Callahan, and she mentioned this story about this young woman who had a horse that, you know, that she finds that, you know, horses can reflect their people's issues that need to be healed. And so Linda called me. She was writing The Tao of Equus. And she interviewed me for that book with my mare Dharma. And I was, of course, thrilled and excited. Yeah. Yeah. First edition. And just so excited to hear about her work and what she was doing. And in particular, the you know, shamanic and emotional experiences that she was having, in addition to her amazing skills and knowledge. And so she wrote about Dharma in that first book, and we connected over the years. And then a few years later, my dear friend Connie, who I just had met, you know, it's like how things happen. Sometimes the most beautiful things happen because someone else, you know, connects you with someone. And Connie was one of those people, is one of those people. And, she mentioned, after I had just met her and she was raving about my art, she said, "Oh, did you know Linda Cohan is teaching a workshop at my friend Sandra Wallen's in Canada?" And I said, "No, oh my gosh, I have a same weekend. I would have loved to have attended that, but I have signed up with one of Linda's approved instructors for a workshop that same weekend. I've already paid for it. Darn, you know." And so Connie took that to mean, "I wish I could come." She took that to mean, "I want to come." And so she put my name on the waiting list without me actually knowing about it. And also, unbeknownst to me, there were 5 people ahead of me on the waiting list. So the chances of actually going were pretty slim anyway. And about a month later, I got a phone call that says, you're able to come to the workshop. And I said, "What workshop?" Because I didn't actually even know I was signed up. So that was, and all 5 people that, you know, somebody had canceled, and all 5 people couldn't make it. And thank goodness I did, because that was where it all began. That was the first time I had worked with one of Linda's approved instructors. And that was an epiphany in and of itself. That was an experience beyond words that I couldn't put words to, because it was so emotional to be, even though I had experienced horses in these experiences of being with them and seeing their beauty, I had never been in their presence in that kind of therapeutic way. And I was shocked and astonished at the emotion that came about from that, that was tapping into something way deeper than I even was conscious of. And so when I met Linda, I was primed to be exploring that. What is that? And how do I paint that? And how do I express that, not only from the horse equation and connection, but the human heart? And through Linda's work and the body scan and what she teaches of being with the presence of horses and resonating with them and asking entering a dialogue with the energy field of the horse and being in their presence in that way, just opened up an entirely new awareness of how my art had the same effect on people. I began thinking about, you know, when people stand in front of my paintings, this is the experience they're having. It's almost like they're standing in front of a living horse. And so I began thinking about that and some other experiences at that workshop. And shortly thereafter, I began talking a little with Linda about my curiosity. And she had been aware of my art and actually collected it, I think, when we first met. And I began having experiences with that, and then she invited me to exhibit my art and be part of her slide presentation that she was doing in town while she was in the Seattle area. And long story short, we met at a bookstore, East West Bookstore, metaphysical bookstore, and I just had this feeling like there was something on the horizon. There's something here about my work and Linda. And I talked with the bookstore owner, who at first was actually kind of not all that friendly. And then she softened the more she was around us and my art. And she said, you know, maybe you should do a card deck. And I'm like, oh. And so she introduced me to a card deck by Brian Froud, who's a fairy artist who I just adore. And I bought the deck. And I, just that whole night, I'm like, there's something about this. And the next day, I was picking Linda up at her hotel. We were going to travel to this next venue. And she got in the car, and I said, I just have to say something. I feel like there's something here about my art and your work and your words and your skills and communication and what my art does with people and how they feel about it and when they're in the presence of the horse in my art. And so I just have this idea. What would you like to do a card deck together? And she said, wow, that actually really could be a key to something that I've been working with myself. And we, you know, got all excited about the idea. And so Linda said, and I showed her the deck with Brian Froud's work. And she said, let's draw a card, see what, you know, what the deck says. And it's a deck of fairy beings. So there, I didn't know that there were any horses in there, but there actually was only one. In the sense of this character of the fairy was named, and Linda's work is called Epona Quest, after the goddess of the horse, Epona. And the only card in the deck that had anything to do with horses we picked, and it was called Epona's Wild Daughter.
Wow.
We just looked at each other, and we just like, okay, we're in for a ride. And the card was very relevant to the theme that we were exploring. And she went home and called her publisher and said, would you be interested in this project? And 2 weeks later, we had a contract. So it was a beginning of a very happy relationship and friendship with Linda and an amazing collaboration, which just led me down the path of my own healing, you know, healing with horses for myself and for other people, which was really what I've always sought anyway, is when I began finding that people had these emotional reactions to my work, I knew there was more that could be explored there. And so this was just the perfect key to beginning that journey.
So with this, so the card deck is called Way of the Horse, Equine Archetypes for Self-Discovery. And the artwork for that, was that art that you already had drawn and you decided to put them on the cards, or did you draw those specifically for that card deck?
It was a mix. Primarily, it was artwork I had already done, and Linda looked through my portfolio of probably at that time there was about 300 paintings that she chose and we chose together through interactions with some of her instructors and clients. We began sort of doing test runs of which pieces brought out which emotions and which elicited certain feelings. And Linda was really interested in taking her work that she'd been doing with clients in the presence of horses and putting it in a way that people could access that wasn't, you know, them physically at a workshop. And so she had the emotional message chart and things that Carla McLaren, she had adopted from her and other of her principles that she wanted to express. So she looked at my portfolio and said, this would be a perfect card for this. And then as we engaged in all that, we began realizing that the stories of her horses and mine were also part of that journey and what was equally important or more so. So I volunteered to say, you know, why don't I do some other paintings for the deck that are about that concept? So of her horses, one of whom was Noche, who she called the Master of Sadness, and her horse Merlin and Spirit, that was her stallion that she rescued, and his twin son that was premature, and also Spirit and his brother, the twins, that his brother had passed at birth, and the archetype and the beautiful story of that, of the healing and the gift of Spirit's birth. And then I painted also my mare, Dharma, in Dharma's reflection. It's an image of her eye, which was based on a photograph that I had taken in her stall when I was photographing her. And for some uncanny reason, which no one, including the photographers I've spoken with, can explain, there was a reflection in her eye of herself. And so she was, her in her eye is an image of her standing in her own stall. And none of us can explain it. So that's Dharma's reflection.
Painting's in the card deck.
Yes.
The picture itself, is it on your website or anything?
The photograph isn't, but I can send it to you. Yeah.
I would love to see that. I would love to see that.
I mean, and this was back in the days of, you know, film and cameras, and the fact that I didn't see it when I photographed it. I was taking a picture of her eye, but when I got it developed, which was the magic of that type of development, was you were often surprised with what you got. When I got the film developed, in the picture, her eye was, you know, this big, but my eye caught it, and I was like, what is that? And I blew it up, and I was like, oh my gosh, how did, you know, and so.
It should have been you in a camera.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And it's appropriately the card for self-reflection in the deck. So it's just that mirror of infinity of what is relationship? What is, who am I? Who are you? Who are we together? That kind of thing. And then the other concept that I depicted, which was a challenge but a joy, was the mare-headed goddess, which is an archetypal, a goddess that was in the early times of our history, who was sort of shunned after, was overshadowed by the male-dominated culture, but was a goddess and literally had at that time, there was very little written about her, but she's a form, a hippomorphic form of the goddess Demeter. And so she's a woman's figure with a horse head. And so I depicted that as well, which was a lovely complex challenge of how to anatomically blend those two together in a realistic way.
I'm just, wow. During that, you mentioned you were in a metaphysical bookshop, and the owner of the bookshop didn't seem that friendly, and then seemed to warm up to you. What do you think that was?
Again, the art paved the way for something to happen between us that was that opened her heart, and I think it was, in her case, we never got to have a conversation about why, but or whether she had anything to do with horses or any interest in horses. But my impression was that when we came in, you know, she was just being her business self, and she was setting us up with a lecture that Linda was going to do. And for whatever reason, she was busy with her organizing. But I felt, after the reading, that she didn't want to let me go without having some kind of conversation. And I can't remember now what that conversation was, but it was something like, you know, I felt like the horse, like Linda's lecture had opened her up, and that the lecture included art and not just my art, but examples of art. And the horse throughout history. So I had the feeling that she came into the conversation with the idea of this was just another author, just another whatever, and that the event itself tapped into something within her that had to do with the horse. And I think that there, the horse is that way. Even people who don't think that they are connected with horses or have any interest in horses will have something shift in them, even in the idea of horses. But especially if they have any other fuel for that beautiful fire to ignite, it lights up something in them.
Yeah, the idea I was getting, or the thing I was thinking about, was that she was probably thinking, this talk about horses doesn't really belong in a metaphysical
book. Right.
is what I...
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And exactly. I don't know if that's how you see it, but it's like she warmed up to you guys because she realized, oh, this does belong here. Which brings me to, so Linda came to our, she was a guest on the podcast, and she came to our podcast summit last year. And I was a bit, let's say, intimidated by Linda. Not that she's an intimidating person. This is my problem, but I was thinking she was somebody, you know, and we're nobodies. And when she first got there, when I first met her, she was lovely and everything, but I just felt like there was a little bit of a wall between us. And the story I was telling myself is that, you know, we weren't worthy of Linda, you know what I mean? And then that wall seemed to come down, and this is just the story I'm telling myself. I'd have to really ask Linda what she thought, but I think, I don't know, if you've ever read any reviews of the Tao of Equus, you go on Amazon, read the reviews of Tao of Equus, there's some haters out there who aren't kind of ready to hear that sort of thing. So I'm sure Linda has, in the general horse community, come up against some people who have some opinions, maybe negative opinions, whatever. And the story I'm telling myself, I don't know whether it's true or not, is I think Linda was thinking she was showing up to a bunch of horse people, so she was a little bit reserved about being her full Linda. Mm-hmm. And by the second day, she was full Linda, and it was beautiful. She was amazing. But I just felt like she let us all in initially, but she, you know, I just felt like she was kind of a little bit reserved, almost probably like this bookshop owner.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it just kind of reminded me of that, but it was so cool. Like the podcast summit, it's over 3 days. The first night we have a meet and greet. So we're having it here in Paso Robles this year, but the last 2 years it's been in San Antonio, and it's in this hotel that's in downtown San Antonio that was an old bank built before the crash of Wall Street in the 20s. So it's elaborate. It's beautiful. And on the second floor is this big breakfast dining sort of area. And so we have the night before we have a meet and greet. So all the people who are coming to present, they're there, but all the people who come to listen, they're there. And so you get to meet your favorite whoever, you know. And but that space is available after the summit each day as well. And so lots of people meet there and gather around or whatever. And so I was at dinner one night and someone came in and they said, oh, you should see what's happening on the second floor. I'm like, what? She said, Linda Kohanov has got a group of people around. And like, so, you know, Linda's a big deal and she's been at the summit all day. She could be going to dinner, going up to a room, whatever. No, she's sitting around. She's got a table full of people and she's reading the cards for people. And like people are crying and like it's a full on, and it's like, wow, that is so cool. So
that
cool.
Is she so was spending, cool.
You know, she was spending her time. She could have been doing something else, but no, she was there on the second floor with people reading it, going through this deck of cards, and it was very emotional apparently. So yeah,
and it was
super cool.
It makes me feel like that's so beautiful because it's like at this horse conference about horses and consciousness and whatever you talk about there, that the horses got to, you know, get their hoof in the door, and the art allows them to be present and the synchronicity of picking the cards. And so there's this beautiful conversation that can happen that's totally different than conversation. You know, it's that feeling-based reality that that can happen. It's so magical.
Yeah, and I can't remember the full details, but I think there was someone who, like, had a specific question.
Right.
Not for Linda.
Yeah.
For the universe sort of thing.
Yeah.
And they were having, I don't know, I seem to remember there was a mother and a daughter, and it had something to do with a mother and a daughter. I forget exactly what it was, but the story I heard was it was very powerful, and it was so cool having Linda, just offer her time.
That's so wonderful.
To do that. So after you guys did the card deck, did that open new doors for you and your art?
Yeah. So I often feel like it, you know, it led me to my human herd. It paved the way even more than I had up to that point, where I no longer had to justify or define as much of who my audience were. That this was my people, and Linda's work attracted them for the various ways in which her work is in the world, and therefore I just had that same access to that conversation. And I had been studying with Linda myself, and then we began teaching some workshops together where we taught Horses Muse, and I began working with students, her students, but in my own way with her, in ways of putting their own marks on paper, of defining what they were feeling from the horses, and giving them some tools from an artistic standpoint of how to tap into those nonverbal emotions that can't always be even journaled. They're just deeper than words. And so that was really, it's been an amazing journey and has led me to where I am now, doing another card deck with my collaborator, Sandra Wallen, who is the woman who I met at that same milestone event of meeting Linda. I also met Sandra. She was hosting the workshop and facilitating it. And now we've written a book together, The Council of Horses Oracle, that's coming out this fall. So that is sort of the next stage of this beautiful journey of expressing this horse consciousness in art and writing in ways that people can tap into, in that synchronistic way that you're describing, of asking questions of these amazing beings that seem to have a connection with humanity, and are here to help us in these amazing ways. And so it's definitely set me on the path of what I came here to do. And when I look back and I think about that, you know, because even preparing for your show, I've done some journaling and thinking about how did this all happen, because I'm always curious myself. And it was in me, in my early childhood, that the horse was this vehicle for me. But also then my horse became the vehicle, because she connected me with Linda, and her, the need to help her and other horses who I believed needed humanity to become aware of them and see them differently and treat them better. And their sentience just all has gone hand in hand. There's no way to separate any of it. But and then the card deck, feeding back into my own experiences, my own healing experiences, picking the cards from Way of the Horse, that led to epiphanies about her and my connection, my horse, Dharma, and I. It's this beautiful spiral that just keeps unfolding. And then meeting other people who have the same experience with their horses, and then my portraits of their horses that lead them to their self-awareness. It's such a beautiful experience, and it's all the horse. It's all the magic.
Mm. Can you tell us more about the book you're doing with Sandra?
Yeah, it's we've been working on it for several years, and we found this amazing publisher, Inner Traditions Baron Company, in Vermont, and we're just releasing it. It's actually, I just got the news that it'll be literally printed in about a week. So it's a guidebook with for transformation and self-awareness. And it's different than The Way of the Horse, and with Linda's blessing, thank goodness, because she's also, Sandra is one of Linda's approved instructors and was one of her earliest classes and instructors when she was writing the Tao of Equus, probably. So it all comes full circle for Sandra as well. And she and I started working together and began teaching workshops together. She lives nearby in Canada, so we were able to connect in many ways and continue the theme of, we call them drawn to horses. So the idea of doing art and horses as, and Sandra's an art therapist, so she has her, beautiful skills doing that kind of work. And she's an equine assisted, therapist and teacher. And so it was a beautiful collaboration. And this time around, it's different than The Way of the Horse, I would say, because we have taken the approach that the horses are speaking in the first person to the reader from their consciousness. And it's I would say it's more of a, Linda explores such complexity of the relational and psychological and scientific exploration of the horse, and the spirituality is woven throughout. I would say that our deck is more comes from the spirit first and foremost, and through the emotions. So it's speaking from the first person of the horse to the reader about how we can get closer to the natural world and not be so focused on the complexities of being a human, find ways of dealing with those complexities, but from a more emotionally wise and spiritually guided place. And so this deck in comparison was also interesting because it was, I would say, well, Sandra did a couple of the paintings in the deck as well because she's got some beautiful skills. And the rest of the deck, I would say about 70% of it is unique new art created for the deck. And one of our other fascinations was wanting to depict the archetypal mythical horses that are throughout many, many cultures that were only touched upon in Way of the Horse. Way of the Horse featured Pegasus and Chiron, the wounded healer. And this deck focuses on even more of the mythical horses like the unicorn, the Kelpie, Longma, which is the Chinese dragon horse, and some other beautiful archetypes, and some that we encountered in our meditations and our exploration of how to express these concepts, and one of which we call the mythic horse, who, when we both meditated with this being, it was a, we both had similar encounters and visions that were unmistakably linked to the same image, which was this, the concept of the horse being as a group consciousness, the archetype, we call him the meta archetype of horses, and that he's not just some being in the sky somewhere that's, you know, that we're looking up to and intrigued by. He's interactive with the consciousness of humanity. So all the love of horses that we express as humans on our in our emotional, spiritual feelings about them, and what we write about them and what we speak about them is all sort of in the give and take and the flow of his consciousness. So his coat was covered in like characters and pictures and movies that were were playing and changing and shifting like a movie screen. And we both saw these like almost tattoo like images, but they were coming and going morphing into him. And so it was the feeling of this interaction with the consciousness of horses, that it's a living, breathing dialogue with the spirit of the horse. So that's, in a nutshell, that's what we're exploring. And we had some difficulty finding a publisher. It's interesting when you approach the marketing world with something that's horse-based. Again, they want to put it in a niche, and our responses from the bigger publishers that we approached were always, this is a niche market. It's, you know, horse people, horse trainers, horse riders. And we're like, the horse is part of our culture through, you know, human history. And we tried to express how the horse is the most painted creature in all of history, from the cave paintings through, you know, the Renaissance and early Greeks and everything. And so it's in us. People who are not horse people are fascinated by horses, you know, and you look everywhere, there's on every movie that you ever see, there's always a horse statue in somebody's fancy office or, you know, so right, yeah. We had to convince them that there was a way that horses could speak to even non-horse aficionados.
Yeah, well, it's like they're the conduit for the message. They're not the message.
Right.
So you had mentioned that Sandra is an art therapist. Can you tell me, do you know what an art therapist does?
You'd have to ask her, but my impression is that they, I would think that they work with someone either in their own drawings that they have them do, or in what they see in things. I don't know. I really am not familiar with the skill, but what we did in our workshops was help people access, first of all, the permission in their psyche to get beyond, and this was the same with Linda Kohaniff's work, Horse's Muse, was first you have to get people beyond the restrictions that says, I can't draw. And the judgments that we have about that. And then it's a matter of them learning that it's not about making something that looks representational or whatever, and which anyone in the presence of a beautiful horse is going to want to draw, you know, a beautiful horse, but then they get frustrated with what they draw and that it doesn't look like what they want and da da da. So if you approach it from a more spiritual perspective and you go from a feeling base, then it gets into the abstract drawing or the color that you choose or whatever that you're trying to put into a nonverbal symbol is the what becomes the dialogue. And when it comes from a feeling-based sensation, when you're sort of dialoguing with the horse and asking a question of your feelings that you're having inside you, and they give you a picture, which even the people that are not used to having that kind of dialogue off almost invariably have in the presence of horses. That's always been the key to me, is that the horses are the catalyst, because somehow they open us up to that potential, and then the art gives it a way to be expressed. And so that's my take on the idea of art as a therapy. The expression of the art can become a way of expressing those emotions that journaling or, you know, that kind of thing doesn't really tap into. And that's just human nature. You know, I'm always fascinated by the cave paintings. When I first began my spirit sketches, I think even Geska maybe had remarked on them that they reminded her of cave paintings. And
they do, yes.
Yeah. And I have always been intrigued by the idea that even in studying the history of that for our Council of Horses Oracle, I was intrigued and fascinated to learn more about what that meant in the culture of those people, and how there's been a lot of study of that's gone beyond the fact that these were, you know, shamanic drawings of painting their prey, you know, because certainly some of those cultures ate horses. But that actually, as further study has gone on, that it was not about hunting. In fact, the creatures that they depicted weren't usually the ones they were hunting. They were ones they revered. And it wasn't a cultural shamanic attraction, you know, trying to find their prey. It was their time and again finding that it was more about the dialogue with nature and what they wanted to emulate and experience. And that artists in that culture were, I was particularly thrilled to read that they were, to really look at it from the perspective of normally people in those cultures would have had to have been hunter-gatherers so they could contribute to the tribe, but that these people were given exalted status so that they could be in these caves and have these experiences and draw these amazing, evocative, spiritual icons that no one else could. They had been given that gift, and that they were supported by their tribe in order to do so. They, you know, they were brought food, and they were brought, given the time away from their, you know, like a shamanic healer. And so that was fascinating to me. And the fact that people the world over are still so fascinated by those drawings and they still exist is just amazing.
Yeah, it's interesting. While you were telling me that, I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. If you were going to spend the time doing that, you wouldn't be out hunting and gathering. So the rest of the clan would be supporting them.
And the horses, Wendy Williams' book, The Horse, is one of my favorites that talks about a lot of this. And she said the horse was one of the most depicted in the caves, much less in human history, but they were at least 30% is what I think the figure I remember hearing. But not always, you know, it wasn't anything necessarily always to do with, anything to do with the hunting. It was, you know, and the way the horses are depicted in naturalist poses and, you know, and whether there were human, you know, there's all sorts of study about it, but it's just amazing to me that that those drawings, that pigment on stone, you know, are just incredible, the whole feeling of it. And the pastel that I work with, I often liken it to the feeling of cave paintings in the sense that it's a earth-based mica, you know, any artistic medium is that way, but it feels like earth. It's sort of a gritty, soft, sand-like quality and the paper I work with is even a bit like a sandpaper, so it's kind of a textured feeling somatically when I work with it.
What is the paper you work with?
One of my favorite papers is called La Carte, and it is literally like vegetable fibers on the that are applied to the paper to give it a tooth. So it has a beautiful natural feel.
Yeah, I'd never given any thought to different types of paper. Do you find that you're just drawn to that type of paper, or do you feel that you can't do the work you do on a different type of paper?
The paper, as I evolved with pastel and I've learned more and more about how to use it, I reached a limitation with the earlier papers that were smoother that I worked with, because I wanted to put more layers of color and texture, and I began, like, it began to where it could no longer take another layer of pastel, for instance. And so I, as they invented this paper, as I, about midway through my career, I began working with that. And the moment I found it, it was like, this is almost, I don't need to find a different paper ever, because this is everything I love to do. Though I will say that the smoother papers that I work with, are necessary for the more the spirit sketch style, because it has to have a flow to it that doesn't, that continues to move on the paper. Whereas the Lacarte paper is more for layers of realism that's depth and light and shadow and effects. Mm-hmm. But pastel as a medium is something very beautiful to work with. If anyone who wants to explore it, it's a very intuitive. I once read an article by an artist who said one of the reasons he loved pastel was because it was an extension of his hand. It doesn't feel like you're holding a brush or holding something that's not tactile. You're actually touching the paper and moving it with your hands. It's like finger painting.
Come full circle. Come back to finger painting.
Right. Exactly.
You start there and you end there. Okay, yeah. We should get to some of these questions that you've chosen. And the first one that you chose was, if you could spread a message throughout the world, one that people would listen to, what would that be? Or your favorite quote, or both if you choose.
Ah, right. Well, I'm not much for remembering words, so I never can remember quotes, but my message would be, though I will say that as quotes go, I know I would like to recommend the author who I did remember. His name is Hans Heinrich Eisenbart. I love everything he ever wrote about the horse. It's that's the closest thing I ever found to the poetry of the horse, and who they are as beings. But as far as a message, I mean, it's what you explore in your podcast. I would say the sentience of horses and how they're not here just to be our servants. The fact that they have such an amazing generosity of heart and social structure that they want to engage with humans and be in partnership with us has always been fascinating to me. And yet there's the dark side of that, of the use of the horse in whatever culture. And it's like it, even in ancient history and looking at all these myths that we explored in our Council of Horses Oracle, there was both the amazing wisdom of the horse that was so revered in the different cultures. There was even, we found the concept, it's called hippomancy, which was they used horses as a divination tool in early, and not, don't quote me, but it's like early Grecian or Roman culture where they would ask questions of these horses, and depending on how they walked or how they divined what, I think they would put spears on the ground or sticks on the ground, and they would define it like an oracle deck. But you could have a Pona and, you know, and the goddess of the horse and whatever on one hand, but then of course they were used for war and to carry mankind to conquest. So, and so the fact that they are our partners is equally that they can be used. And so I hope that more and more people awaken to their sentience. And I'm so excited to be in this time in history where people like Linda Kohanoff and your podcast and people who listen to this are celebrating this incredible being and their wisdom, rather than just what they can do for us on a physical and entertainment level.
So if you're not good at remembering quotes, I'll give you one. last year at our podcast summit in Australia, Nashon Cook was there, and he said something that I had to write down. I only wrote down two things in my phone, in the notes in my phone, out of the whole weekend. And I had to capture this exactly how he said it. And he said, "They are healing the world we used them to conquer."
Oh, that just sinks into my bones.
Maybe he said they are help. Maybe he said they are help healing the world help we used healing. Them to conquer. But and it'll hit me between the eyes like a big stick. And I'm like, I got to write that down before I forget it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I only wrote two things down. There was that one, and Jane Pike said, "There is no balance. There is only balancing."
That's equally beautiful.
And yeah, those are the two things I wrote down from the whole weekend, and there was so much cool stuff, but
yeah,
I can remember it, but those I wanted to remember, I wanted like the exact words they said. It was so cool. Okay, next question for you is, what do you feel is your true purpose in the world?
Well, it segues from the first conversation to this, which is my art has given me a way of expressing those feelings of the sentience of horses in ways that people who are skeptical about it, maybe even, or are on the verge of discovering it for themselves, it gives them a way to access that there must be something more, because they can't explain their feelings and emotions about a given work of art. And I would go to horse shows and events where there was all manner of, you know, things going on with horses, and invariably people would run across my booth and come up to a painting, and we'd start talking, and they'd tell me their story of their brother who passed away, or when they lost their first horse, or some kind of emotion would happen that they couldn't explain. They'd be like, "I don't even know why I'm telling you this story." I remember one night, one woman who was contemplating purchasing this painting that I had called Flamenco, and she said, I just have to think about it. I really can't afford it, you know, and all of that. And as she left, I said, "You'll probably dream about him tonight." And she came the next day and she said, "I dreamt about that painting all night." So I just am so honored. I've had so many of my own spiritual epiphanies around when I felt this way about horses and I wanted to put this into my art, but I really didn't know myself what I was tapping into until I began learning about shamanism and learning about Linda Kohanoff's workshops, having these experiences with horses who were able to be their true selves, and they were given the opportunity in the setting in which people can receive that information to really shine. And I began having these profound experiences of tapping into that wisdom. And once I began realizing that what I'd been painting all the way along was of that same consciousness, I just felt like I had even more incentive to keep pursuing that goal of trying to reach more and more people who could feel that way about horses and maybe awaken some that were on the cusp of that, and for the betterment of the planet for the horses, yeah, and for them.
Certainly.
Yeah.
Yep. So next question you chose is, what do you feel is the luckiest thing that ever happened to you?
I was going to tell the story about Geska in that event. So the other experience I would say was I had the honor of presenting a work of art to President Ronald Reagan when he was after he was in office. And that came about in such a magical way. It was definitely a luck kind of thing, that I had the idea and the way of connecting with him in a way that is just unexplainable, really. But it happened through a series of events. So I can share that if you'd like.
Please do. I'm all ears now. My ears have just pricked up. Did you see them lean forward? Like, I'm like a horse when you shake the food bucket.
Well, it was a dear family friend had sent me a picture of Ronald Reagan's horse. And interestingly, it was a Liberty shot. It wasn't him riding him, which is probably why it got my attention. He's a beautiful Arabian horse named El Alamein. And he was given to him when he was when he was governor of California, by the president of Mexico. And I didn't know at the time what a horseman Ronald Reagan was. But I've since watched documentaries about him, and that's one of the reasons why they purport to his, you know, his personality and his ability to communicate with people and his skill as a president was because he was such an incredible horseman and really down to earth. And this particular horse, I guess, was actually quite, in fact, Linda has written about him in her book. He had a fractious nature, so he was a bit of a challenge, like no one else could ride him kind of thing. But all I knew was he was beautiful. And I actually was hiring a PR firm that was located where I lived on Bainbridge Island and to try to promote my art. And they, one of their on their bio was that they had been former aides of President Reagan when he was in office. And so I said, well, I've got this picture of his horse, you know, wouldn't it be wonderful if I could somehow connect with him, hint, hint. And they, you know, kind of said, well, we'll see, you know, we have some connections, but we can't promise anything, but you know. And so, I don't know, about 6-8 months went by and they said, if you'd like to try, we can try to connect. We can't promise anything. So his birthday was coming up in February, I think it was, and I began painting the horse and this beautiful, how it evolved even was, you know, the way an artist's mind works is not always a direct line of thinking. So I didn't know exactly what I was going to put in the background. And so I was thinking of the color for a background behind this beautiful running white horse. And I was thinking, well, blue is kind of like a royal blue and red is very rich and looks very, you know, and then it's a white horse. And I went, oh, and I thought the flag. So that was, you know, roundabout way. So I painted the American flag behind this beautiful white horse. And I was actually very careful to think, is this even, you know, I knew that the flag has a whole protocol about how you handle flags and it's not supposed to touch the earth and that kind of thing. So is it okay for a horse to be even walking on it? So I kind of depicted it in such a way that he's sort of floating above it. So I waited, you know, could we connect with his office? And they finally came back just at the last minute, like a week before his birthday, they said, well, we have an interesting situation. So President Reagan has been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and they've just announced that he's no longer going to be doing public events. He's retiring from public life. However, his staff are really, really heartful and want to keep him engaged in life. And they've decided that this might be a nice way to celebrate his birthday. So if you can get on a plane in a week, we'll get you down to meet him and present your painting. And so my mom and I, first thing we did was we went shopping to get new outfits to wear. And while we're getting the painting framed, I think we maybe had it framed by that time, but we had no idea, you know, it was the last minute. And so very exciting. Got to the airport, and fortunately the staff that was going with us, David had been on his staff, and he was going to help usher us through this whole, like, felt like the royal welcome, you know. And our way was made clear, and we shipped the painting on the plane we were on to make sure that it arrived with us. And so we get to the airport, and we're the first ones, at, you know, early morning in the Seattle airport, having taken the ferry from Bainbridge Island to the airport, and we're the first ones there. We're all dressed up, and the flight attendant, gate woman, is she just was like, "You two look so beautiful. You just don't see people dress up for flight anymore, you know." Like, and so we couldn't help it. We had to tell her the story. Well, we're going to meet President, you know, Ronald Reagan, and she says, "I'm going to upgrade you to first class." So we got to fly first class. So that was so fun, and we arrived in his offices in Century City. You know, later that early afternoon. And we get to his office, and it's, you know, you would never know his office was there. It was like a typical office building. And we're right. But, you know, once you go in the lobby, it was like the Secret Service agent comes from out behind the counter. And we ride up in the elevator with the Secret Service agent, and I've got the art in a big, like a case, a soft bag. And he's checking out the bag. You know, and I'm like, you know, like there might be something dangerous in there. And as he's right. doing that, he peeks at the art and he says, "Oh, El Alamein." And I said, "Yeah, do you know him?" Because I'm thinking, you know, he's still living. And he said, "No, he passed away about 3 years ago." And I said, "Oh, that's even more amazing and sad. But maybe this will, you know, cheer him up." So we get to the upstairs, and they usher us into his office, which is, you know, wall to wall awards and everything. And everybody's very formal. And then President Reagan came out and shook our hands. And it was adorable because my mom was so excited to meet him as well. And we made small talk, but his personal assistant was introducing us in turn, and there was sort of a brief moment where my mom didn't get noticed. So she walked up to him, stuck out her hand and said, "Hi, I'm Mom." And he's such a gracious man. He just immediately picked right up on that, and he got a big kick out of it. But you could tell, you know, having been around people who'd had been affected by Alzheimer's, I could tell that he was affected and that right. he wasn't tracking completely. But it was still a pleasure, and his genuine spirit was completely intact. He was very kind and gracious. And so I had the painting on the floor with facing away from him. And so I didn't know how this was going to go, you know? And so I picked it up and I turned it towards him and I said, "I'd like to present you with a painting of El Alamein." And he just stood there and looked at it for a long moment. And then his first words were, "You did this for me?" And it was just, it wasn't the Alzheimer's talking. It was his heart. And I really felt it. He just was in awe. He just, you know, took him right out of the formality of the occasion and just heart to heart. And then we, you know, all posed for pictures, and I was totally out of my body at that point. So I remember thinking, as you know, like, he took our hand and we're smiling for the camera, and it's not like press or anything. It was just his, you know, his staff, but it was still an amazing experience. And I thought, actually, that was the most tactile feeling, to have his hand in mine, you know, to stand next to him and have his hand in mine. It's like, you know, this is just completely unreal. And his, then his next comment was, "I want to hang it in here." And his personal assistant is looking around like, this is a huge painting. There is no way we're going to fit it in here. But the fact that he, you know, even wanted it or would say that was really touching. And so it was quite an amazing experience of setting an intention, having something so completely, you know, off the radar of something that I ever could dream of, and then having it happen. And ironically, later when I talked to his staff, you know, I have to admit there was a part of me that was like, oh, I'm going to be in People magazine or, you know, something like that. Like, this will be my, my launch into notoriety. And, they said, well, we can't really broadcast this. This was like, you know, a special condition. And I said, oh, okay, that's fine. I'm just proud of it. And, you know, I can talk about it, but, it is a great honor and it was a great experience. And it, since then, even knowing, having watched these documentaries and knowing how much the horse means to him and how that horse in particular, actually, like I said, Linda has researched it a bit more than I, and had interviewed some of the Secret Service agents that knew Reagan at that time, who literally had to keep up with him because he was such a good horseman that he'd just leave him in the dust and he really didn't care. He wanted to get away from them, kind of thing, and go riding. That horse was a challenge, and they had to have the special relationship or he could have never ridden him. And that was just a barometer of the skill and love he had for horses and what kept him so grounded. So I think that, it was my brush with fame for sure. And the painting is, at times hanging in the presidential library. So that's really a fantastic thing to know and feel. Yeah.
Wow. Tell me, what was it like when were you in the room first and he walked in?
Mm-hmm.
What is it like? Because I think I've experienced this a couple of times. Somebody that you've seen a million times on TV and then you see them in real life and it's almost, you know, have you ever jumped out of a plane?
I have actually.
When you go up in a plane for the first time to skydive and you're in the plane and then the door slides open and then people start rolling out the door, for me, this looks just like the movies, but it's not the movie. Because you said at one point in time you had this out-of-body experience. When he walked in, is there like a, whoa, you know, did that happen to you? Or was it like, yeah, there's old Ronnie?
Oh, no, absolutely. That was definitely the feeling. And I cannot tell if it was his presence and my feeling of his celebrity or if it was the circumstances or anything. But if I put my finger on it, I would say it reminds me of when I got married, because my husband and I had been together 11 years because we considered ourselves married. We just hadn't had a formal wedding. So my idea was, this will just be like one more beautiful day with my loved one, you know, and it's a way of commemorating what we have already. So it's not going to be a really, you know, a big, like, you know, angels singing the choir kind of moment. It'll be beautiful, but I had no idea that the ceremony and the event and the being there among witnesses and everything about that moment and that day was heightened and completely surreal. It's never just about, you know, we're just having a normal day.
Right.
So that was the same feeling, if I could think of it that way. It was like, this is not a normal experience. And regardless of whether he's a celebrity or whether I've seen him on TV or who he is or any of that, there is a heightened experience that that there's more going on here. And then when that heightened experience in this case turned into a very personal moment and wasn't just the pomp and circumstance or press or something, that I'm actually really grateful that none of that was there, because it allowed me to see his heart, and him to feel ours, as real people. Mm. And that was more priceless.
Mm. Wow.
And yeah.
Thank you for sharing that story. That is a very, very cool story.
It's a good memory. Yeah.
I bet. Okay. Well, it's been such fun hearing your journey, and especially finishing up with that story. That was so cool. So how can people find you?
Yeah, so my website is spiritofhorse.com, and my book with Linda was The Way of the Horse. She was the gifted author, and I did the illustrations, and then my new book is coming out, The Council of Horses Oracle, in fall of 2024. And I have e-cards with my beautiful music and writings. I'm also a writer, so a lot of those things that I do are writing as well as art. And I'm really, please reach out to me. I love connecting with people, and you know, horses are my favorite subject, so we'll never get enough of them.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining me. It's been an absolute pleasure. And you guys at home, thanks for joining us. And we'll catch you on the next episode of the Journey On podcast.
Thanks for listening and thanks for having me.
Thanks for being a part of the Journey On podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick has over 850 full-length training videos on his online video library at videos.warwickschiller.com. Be sure to follow Warwick on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram to see his latest training advice and insights.